Case 23 in the Gateless Barrier. That head monk Ming said, "I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." And the six ancestors said, without thinking good or bad, "At this very moment, what is your original face?" At that instant, Ming realized great awakening. Like that. And sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Besides these secret words and this secret meaning you've just revealed to me, is there anything of further significance?" And the six ancestors said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not a secret. If you shine back, reflect back on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." And Ming said, "Though I practiced at Huang Mei, the fifth ancestors, with the assembly, at that time I could not realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointing out instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it's hot or cold. Lay brother, now you are my teacher." And the ancestor said, "Well, if you say that, then let's both call Huang Mei, the fifth ancestor, our teacher. We're both his students. Maintain your new realization carefully." And that's the end of the long koan story. Of course, the center of the koan is just, without thinking good or bad, what is your original face? But there's a lot of other nice minor points here too. Like sweat running from the entire body when shocked into such a ordinary but radically new perspective. And in tears, he bowed, great out of gratitude, right? But and we could say he's kind of asking, "This is really great, but you know, it's pretty simple and ordinary. Is there something more?" He wants to know, right? Besides these secret instructions and this secret meaning, is there anything of further significance? So the six ancestors could have said, "What? You want something more? Are you not satisfied with your original face? Your original face, everything is included within it already, so there's nothing lacking." But he didn't say that. Instead, the ancestors said, "What I have just conveyed is not secret." And I think it's interesting that switching back now to the modern headless way, the teachers of the headless way, these little exercises, they say, they use this word, this is your kind of secret private face. Private, maybe they say private, but it's kind of like secret, your original face, because nobody else can see it. They see your public face, right? In other words, you can look at the end of Kokyo's finger, and you see something very different than Kokyo sees at the end of his finger, right? At the end of Kokyo's finger, you see his public face. It looks like this. But he doesn't see that one. He sees his secret face, his private face, that doesn't look like the one that you see. Do you understand? And it's same for all of you. You have your secret face, that when I look for it, all I see is your public face. But you have a secret face. But it's not that secret because actually I kind of know what your secret face looks like. It looks exactly like mine. Our public faces all look different, but our secret faces, our private intimate face. I think it's a I can't remember the Chinese character that they use for secret, but I think it's like Mitsu, I think. Not sure, but which means something like secret, but also like very intimate, private or intimate. So I just thought that was an interesting connection, right? We're using this old story from Tang Dynasty China combined with this, the Douglas Harding's Headless Way, and I think there's just a lot of correlation. Secret face and public face. So, the Head Mung Ming is saying this amazing secret that you've passed to me, right? Is there something more? And the teacher says, it's not secret, really. And then he says, if you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you. Or you could say, it's not, it won't be secret to you, it's very obvious to you. It's secret to everybody else, even though they have their own secret face, which it might be so secret that maybe most people maybe don't really realize their original face, even though it's right, it's the most obvious thing. It's here as soon as we look. But why don't most people recognize and appreciate their original face? Well, like this morning, as I said, one story would be because it's so boring. That's a little facetious. I mean, maybe boring is not quite the right word. But it just strikes me again and again how we're so caught up in the world of appearances because they're so interesting. The content of our face is so interesting, but the nature of our face is so ordinary that it's very easy to overlook. So, and the text says, like shine back. So I mentioned this term this morning, echo hensho. It's used by like all these Chinese ancestors, and Dogen Zenji, our founder, uses it in his essential Zazen instructions when he says that in the Fukan Zazengi of Dogen, he's trying to teach Zazen, the secret method of Zazen, and he says a lot of things. For example, turn the light around and shine it back. He says, put aside the intellectual practice of pursuing words and following after speech, which is a little bit like just don't think about good and bad for a moment. And then Dogen says, turn the light around and shine it back. Echo Hensho, literally. Turn the light around, the light of attention, around and shine it back. body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will manifest. Dogen Zazen instructions. So, yes, this is a Zazen instruction. He says other things too, but it's one of my favorite parts of the Fukan Zazengi. Turn the light around and shine back. Body and mind, you could say the body and mind that we usually think we have or think we are, that one will drop away, and your original face will manifest. If you want such a thing, then practice such a thing immediately, Dogen says. But I bring this up because it's this classic Zen phrase, Ekko Hensho, that many, many ancestors used before Dogen. And this Platform Sutra has the term Hensho. So it doesn't have the full Ekko Hensho, but that's what it says right here. Interestingly, I thought to look at the Chinese. What I have conveyed to you, the ancestor says, is not a secret. If you shine back on your own face, the face of your self, it says, Hensho Jiko Men. So literally like, shine back on the self's face, or on your own face. The secret is right there, basically, is what he says. So my geeky mind appreciates how this Ekko Hensho, half of that term, is woven into the original face story. And I think that's in the Platform Sutra. Unless the collector of the koans kind of changed the Chinese a little bit, which sometimes they do, but I bet it's there in the Platform Sutra, Hensho. So shining back. And then the secret is yours, basically. And then Ming, the head monk, says, I've been practicing a long time. Might say in parentheses, a lot longer than you, illiterate woodcutter who just showed up and working in the kitchen. But I never really got it. You got it quickly. I practiced at Huang Mei with you and with the assembly, but I didn't realize my original face. But now, thanks to your simple instruction of what simple instruction? What is your original face? Now I'm like someone who drinks water and personally knows myself if it's hot or cold, which is that phrase from the Platform Sutra got kicked around in the Zen halls after this too. Dogen Zenji uses this sentence in the Bendoa, the wholehearted practice of the way. Dogen usually doesn't talk about like kind of a awakening experience kind of thing so often, but in this early writing, maybe the first writing of Dogen, he does mention that. I think we can hear this as Dogen says verification of reality is like drinking water and knowing for yourself whether it's hot or cold. So I think it's a beautiful, simple, common image, right? For like, you know whether it's hot or cold. You maybe can't describe it, but you know for yourself. And it is a particular something to know, right? This water's hot. This water's cold. So it's an interesting phrase that Dogen picks up from this story. I think this is the first time, probably, it's used, since this is the early days of Zen. I couldn't realize my original face, but now I'm like someone who drinks water, and I know for myself whether it's hot or cold. Therefore, you're now my teacher. And the sixth ancestor very humbly says, well, that's wonderful, but you don't need to call me your teacher. Let's both call the fifth ancestor our teacher, right? Because I got it from him. And if they went to the fifth ancestor and they bowed and said, we're both your teachers, he said, that's wonderful, but why don't you say the fourth ancestor is all of our teacher? And they go to the fourth and say, you're our teacher. There's more and more of them gathering. And the fourth says, that's great that you all feel that way, but really, we're all disciples of the third ancestor. We're all disciples of Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma says, we should just say we're disciples of Shakyamuni Buddha. And then Shakyamuni Buddha says, that's great you say that, but there's seven other Buddhas before me. We're all disciples of Bibashi Butsu Daiyosho. And then Bibashi Butsu Daiyosho. Now there's like thousands, millions, they're all saying, we're all your students. And Bibashi Butsu of the ancient Kalpa says, that's great you all say this, but really, we are all students of your original face. Exactly. So that's the story. And then in the collection, the Mumon Khan, Mumon. So the Mumon Khan is the gateless barrier. And so it's sort of a play because you could see this collection of koans. Each koan is a barrier with no gate through it. But also, the one who collected the koans, his name is Mumon. His name is gateless, no gate. So this whole collection of koans is Mumon's barrier. So Mumon offered the comment, short comment. It must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. When he gave this instruction, he basically forgot about himself. And I don't think he had this big plan. He's going to come. He's not going to pick up the robe. And then he's going to ask me. I'm going to say, don't think good or bad. What's your original face? I think it's just spontaneously. It must be said that the sixth ancestor just forgets himself completely in taking action by offering this instruction, right? He's like a kind grandmother who peels a fresh lychee fruit, removes the seed, and puts it into your mouth, like a little child. Then you only need to swallow it. That's Mumon's comment. Can you follow that? It's like a, you know, lychee fruits have this rough skin, I think, right? And a pit. So a little baby, they might choke. They might try to eat the skin and choke on the pit. So a kind grandmother peels all the rough stuff off, takes out that pit that you could choke on. It's all like, all totally digestible and ready, and then just like gives it to the child and just slurp it down. So I think it's beautiful. It's basically saying he gives it to you straight. It's so simple. Just like let go of good and bad. What's at the end of your fingertip when you point it at your where you thought your face was? Oh, it's not a face. So that's Mumon's comment. And then Mumon's verse, he has a comment and a verse. His verse also, they're very straightforward. His verses in the Mumon Khan. His verse is, it can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. So stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the whole world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. Anybody's body breaking out in sweat? Mine a little bit. I mean, that's a big statement, right? The simple, boring, original face is indestructible when the entire world of all these colors and shapes is destroyed, which in a way it's destroyed every moment and a new one arises. But when this whole world is destroyed, there's one that's not destroyed. It must be then deathless. It must be unborn. It's not a conditioned phenomena, because all those conditioned phenomena are destroyed. It can't be described. We can't really describe. We're trying to sort of hint at it, but it can't be described. It can be pointed at, but when we look at that, what's being pointed at, we don't find anything. It can't be described, it can't be pictured, it can't be praised enough. Stop groping or grasping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it's not destroyed. And so to continue the headless way exercises, here's another simple one that you have to be kind of naive and silly to try these things out. But this is basically, if we think that we have two eyes, this is to this is in order to start doubting that. We maybe don't really have two eyes. And here's the way we can kind of like prove it. You can make these glasses for yourself like this in front, right? Or if you have glasses, it might work to look through them, I'm not sure. You might have to take glasses off. But that looks like we have two eyes, right? We're like looking through these two holes, and then bring these new glasses closer and closer to your eyes, closer and closer, closer and closer. Now how many eyes do you have? Isn't it like, didn't it just become one eye? Yeah, it's one eye, right? Out here, if you hold your glasses out here, you have two eyes. But when you bring them very close, very intimately, does this work with actual glasses?
Yeah.
Yeah, it works. If you bring them close, you only have one eye. Right? One eye. And I think that Douglas Harding and these people say this is the one eye experiment, and you can write the EYE as I. We all have one eye, and he says, is that what's meant in these Indian traditions by the third eye? You see, like, I think Prajnaparamita, it's hard to tell, but I think she's got. Well, sort of a hidden third eye, but sometimes the pictures of the Buddhas, they have an actual eyeball on their forehead. And Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So they call the third eye. So is it really like, we have two, and then you have this one eye. Is that actually your third eye? Your secret third eye is this one. And then, but your public face has two eyes. So it looks like all of you have two eyes, but when I look for mine, I only have one eye. Strange, huh? But you don't see my secret eye. You see my two eyes. Like, those are just public eyes. This is the headless way. The headless way lineage. Asks from this perspective of this spacious window that is our original face. You know, we've done these things like we look at our legs and our torso. This is the body that we can see, and we
Right, we did this exercise, we're pointing up past the legs and the torso to the what is looking. So we kind of see like we see this like edges of the body, and then we see like somewhere around the torso, the body like disappears into this empty window, right? The visual body we're talking about. So we could say, from this new perspective, is it that this original face is like in our body? Or is it the other way around, that our body that we see is actually appearing in our original face? It's kind of a reversal of the, we usually think that, especially if we talk about it as awareness or something, many people would say, awareness is in the body. Our consciousness is in the body. And this morning someone asked, well, do amoeba have consciousness? And I was thinking, well, no, not really. But humans actually don't have consciousness either. It's not like people have consciousness. If consciousness is like, or awareness is something like this original face, then that's not in something experientially, right? This window, this empty window, is not in something. But in fact, the whole world and the body that we can see are in the original face. Does that make sense? Experientially, right? The one that you can see, but also you could take the body that you feel, the bodily sensations, some tension in the belly or something, some lunch sitting there, some the breath moving, you could say, you know, where is that happening? Where are these sensations happening from the perspective of the original face? It's not just visions are happening in this original face. All the sensory experiences are happening in it. The other skandhas, all the skandhas, yeah, all five skandhas, forms, and which means colors and sounds and tastes and so on, feelings, concepts, and karmic impulses like desires and aversions, and even the consciousness skanda, that is like the mind that knows objects. You could say all five of these skandhas are arising and ceasing within our original face. Can you follow that? We're talking experientially. Our original face is like this empty field, this spacious, borderless, shapeless, colorless, window-like, one eye. Is it not that every experience we've ever had is happening within this one eye, this original face? You might say, well, that's a cute little exercise, but it's not really how it is. Shouldn't we stay with our direct experience rather than some theories, conceptual theories? This is like drinking water and knowing ourselves whether it's hot or cold, rather than some theory about whether it should be hot or cold, depending on how many degrees Fahrenheit it is. Right? So that's where this is like Zen and rediscovery of the obvious. Zen is like this. Of course, there's lots of theoretical teachings in Buddha Dharma, but Zen is like, let's just really try to stay with our direct present experience and see if we can, if it's a different perspective than our habitual one. So, one of the other exercises in the headless way is like actually using a mirror. So you could say, Well, I know I have a face because I've seen it in the mirror. I can't see it now, but I have seen it before in the mirror. So then the idea is you can hold out a mirror and look at your face and say, well, that's your public face. The one that you see in the mirror is the one that other people see. And you could look at your own out here. You have to put it out here in the mirror in order to see your public face. Because if you bring the mirror closer and closer to your face, it starts to become less and less like your public face. It starts like, is this how other people see me? And like, well, I don't know. It's just like some skin or something, or like a pupil of an eye. And then if you try to put the mirror like right on your pupil, you wouldn't really see anything. And that's when the mirror is no distance from you, then you see your secret face, your original face. You can imagine this with a mirror, right? You might think these exercises are super stupid, but I really enjoy that. There's a flavor. I wouldn't say like my whole body broke out in sweat, but it raised my temperature when trying these exercises out. It's like, no, they're silly little things, but we have to do them in this kind of childlike way to feel the impact. If you just say, well, that's a stupid little thing, then we won't sweat. We like to sweat on a hot day. So, and one more is, they're just so simple, right? These exercises, it involves having a clock. So if you, either a digital clock or a clock with hands, if you have a watch, you can do the exercise. Basically, first find your original face, and then it's almost like you could point at the clock. And you could say, this clock is like moving, right? It's like the hands are moving around the clock. Time is passing on this one. And then on this one, pointing back towards what's looking, is there anything moving there? No, there's not on this side, right? Everything moving is out there. This one's not moving, and if there's no movement, there's no time. So this is your original face is a timeless, beginningless, endless, unchanging face. That's why the Mumon says, when the world is destroyed, it's not destroyed. If it were in time, it would be destroyed. So meanwhile, we're looking out, and there's this time is passing and the hands of the clock are turning, right? So, and then we already have discerned, where's the borderline between these two worlds? Our original face that's timeless and unchanging, and the hands of the clock out there that are moving around and showing the passage of time. There's no border between them. Emptiness itself is form. The timeless itself is moving hands on a clock. Stupid exercises. But I hope you can feel what these are pointing to. And kind of like, you know, proving in this very simple way, if we're open enough to open to something so stupid. And lastly, I just want to mention Dogen Zenji, our Soto founder, is really into what he calls face-to-face transmission. So teacher and student meeting in this face-to-face transmission. We translate it that way, but literally in Japanese, it's menju, which literally means like receiving a face. Face receiving, menju. It's the same face that is used in original face. Original face is honrai men. Like originally become face, original face. And Dogen's term is menju, face receiving. Like jukai means receiving the precepts. This is menju, face receiving. And the Headless Way talks about meeting face to no face. So like I'm looking at Jim, and so I see his public face, and then I see my secret face, and his public face is meeting my secret face. And I mean, this kind of meeting is like, there's no distance, there's no division between his public face and my secret face, and vice versa for him, right? He sees my public face and his secret face, and the Headless Way tradition calls that meeting face to no face. That's a very intimate kind of way of meeting. And I have proposed that this is very similar to what Dogen is talking about with this face-to-face transmission, or literally, face-receiving menju. Like, Dogen says in this essay called Menju, he says, Mahakashapa, that's, you know, when the Shakyamuni Buddha held up the flower, Mahakashapa smiled. And that was the first face-to-face transmission in Zen. And so Dogen says, Mahakashapa pounded his bones, which is a Zen way maybe of saying he practiced really diligently. It was like he was pounding his bones, doing this, what would we say, like, the idea of himself was being molded and crafted like a blacksmith might pound iron, something like this. Mahakashapa pounded his bones for like many years until his face was no longer his own. Then he was able to receive the Buddha's face through face-to-face transmission. It's beautiful. He couldn't, after practicing so long, he couldn't find his own old Mahakashapa face. He lost it. He couldn't find it anymore. And at that time, then when he would meet the Buddha, he was able to receive the Buddha's face as his own. Just like when I look at Jim's face, I receive it as my own. I don't find Kokyo, but what I thought was Kokyo is actually Jim. Do you see how that is? I thought Kokyo looked like that person that he saw in the mirror yesterday, right? But that one's gone now. When I look for Kokyo, all I find is this empty window. And what's in the empty window, filling the empty window? Jim's face. Where I thought Kokyo's face was, is actually Jim's face. And all of your faces, right? See how that's so? I think Douglas Harding, when he first had this insight, the Headless Way founder, he said, I lost a face and gained a world. We might also say it like, I lost a face and gained all of your faces. What is Kokyo, you know, most intimately for me? What is Kokyo? It's all 20 of you. But what about Kokyo's? The face that I thought was Kokyo's face. I don't know. I don't see that one anywhere. But where it used to be, somewhere like in this window where Kokyo's face used to be, your faces. Something like this. Yes. Yes, to carry ourself forward and actualize or verify
the 10,000 things is delusion, but the 10,000 things coming forth, the 10,000 faces coming forth and verifying my original face is awakening, Dogen says. Yeah, like that. Any questions, comments? Yes.
One of the lines or parts of one of the boys appreciate funny enough is not one that you focus more on. It's when the fifth ancestor is being chased by General Ming, and he's like, okay, fine, I want the bullet, I want to rip your pika, and grasps at it, kind of like Excalibur sword. The harder grasp, the heavier.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, that is part of the story here. He went to pick it up. Was it the magical power of this robe and bowl, or was it just that when he tried to take it by force, he's like, what am I doing? I can't take it.
And I found myself, like, I'm grasping for something, whether it be success, love, respect. Yeah. And the more I grasp,
yes.
If there's someone giving it, it's not given. There's no way to take love, take respect. You know?
Yep. Well put. Yeah, just like that.
I find myself tuning up here.
Yeah, that's I think why that part's included in the koan here is we want something that we think is separate from ourselves in order to fulfill ourselves, and we call that grasping, and it doesn't work. and somehow. And that's interesting that it comes at the beginning of this story. He tries to grasp something outside of his true self to fulfill himself, and suddenly realizes that that doesn't work. And in that openness of realizing that that doesn't work, that's when he's able to say, I didn't come here for this, I came for the Dharma. and you could say, because of that openness, that's why he was able to so quickly hear such a stupid instruction and actually get it, have this great realization. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, come on. In the fox koan, you're thinking is kind of similar.
So,
another way we could see the similarity of.
Okay.
Wow.
You're good at this. So sorry. This fox, you know, when you were saying, like your Mahakashapa pounded his face.
His bones.
And his bones. And like dropping off of body and mind, there's like a feeling of complete surrender, to be able to receive the gift.
Yeah.
You know, like the fox, and the beauty of the fox, I don't remember this fox coin exactly, but the fox gave up his life for others. And then everyone's face became their face. I don't know if that makes sense in some way. Like,
I think in the fox koan, it's usually maybe not so much presented as like he did that for others. I think it's more usually seen as it was kind of a mistake that he had a misunderstanding, which is why he fell into this fox body. So I don't know if it was so beneficial, all those hundreds of lives as a fox, if it was so beneficial to others. I hope it was. Maybe those fox lives were beneficial, and they were generating merit, slowly generating enough merit that finally that fox could meet Baijiang and get a turning word that would release him from this fox body.
I mean,
mean, this has a feeling of the, I didn't even remember the koan, I just came again, you know, but this has a feeling of the bodhisattva vow. Sorry, this has a feeling of the bodhisattva vow, the meaning of the bodhisattva vow.
This being able to receive another's face. I think that is kind of bodhisattva.
Dropping off body and mind.
Yes, 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 yes. Of course, it's beneficial to self and others. Yeah. We could say holding on to and identifying with the content, the images in this window is kind of staying trapped in our limited view of ourself, and that's, you know, will eventually won't be so beneficial to others that way. So we're kind of trusting that what would be really beneficial to both the particular practitioner and to everyone that they meet will be more and more releasing this hold on our old face and opening to our true face. And I think Mahakashyapa, because he was able to receive the Buddha's face, I think it was greatly beneficial, because then he was able to give his face to Ananda, who was able to give his face to Shanavasha and down to us. And if they hadn't been willing to do that, it wouldn't have come down to us. So this practice, in that way, is very compassionate to give up a face. Yeah. Yes, very compassionate. Thank you. Yes. Oh, yes, Jim.
Oh. Yes. Well, there's
something else. You were earlier.
Okay. So I always have this, you know, when you talk about it as seeing your original face.
Uh-huh.
I've always felt like, you know, it's kind of a command or something like, and it, you know, kind of leads to grasping. But the way that you expressed, or that translation, I don't know if that's your translation or somebody else's, but, you know, the Ming says, oh, please give me this secret teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And the sixth answer says, it's not a secret.
Yeah.
Just turn back
mm-hmm.
the light. And it didn't say trust, but it sounded like trust that it will be with you. Or it went, I don't know quite how it's put, but...
If you shine back on your own face, the secret it will be there with you, or is yours.
Yeah, it'll just be there with you.
It's
and
there.
To me, that like that, because it's like the secret's coming to you. Just relax.
Just
relax. You know,
and he says it's not a secret, right?
Yeah, it's not a secret.
A secret is something like we think of as something we don't know. Everybody knows that we don't know, or somebody knows we don't know. So he said, what I've just conveyed is not a secret. If you shine back on your own face, the secret is yours, or will be in you.
Mm-hmm.
So then, which means it's not a secret. If it's yours, it's not a secret. So it's not something we, you know, to say we see our original face doesn't really make sense, because. But that's how the exercise. It's a seeing exercise. We're using vision, right? I see the floor. I see the legs. I see the torso. I see my original face, but I don't see anything. So this is the kind of. Seeing our original face is not seeing anything. Not seeing anything. There's no thing there, but all things are appearing within it. All the things I see, in a way, are, I see my original face through seeing all your faces. But I can't, the one thing I can't see as an object is my original face. And the secret is not really a secret. Yes. Oh, how about Oscar?
Thank you. Okay. So this is a fascinating teaching, and I'm kind of trying to grab it little pieces and not entirely successfully, but the examples, the headless examples used are, I think, are all visual.
Yes, yeah.
And I'm thinking of this, the head monk, Myo, or whatever. He's got different names, I think.
I guess Myo in Japanese or Ming in Chinese.
I see. Mm-hmm. Thank you. His analogy to drinking warm water, drinking water knowing for himself, that's such an intimate analogy. It just really strikes home. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because it refers to a very intimate kind of sensation, which is not seeing. It's body sensation of swallowing and temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is something around, does this technique, if you will, of turning within, work with other perceptions?
And even like the headless way method, they say, well, we're acknowledging that these are like visual experiments, but you can apply all the other senses to them. So one would be, it's maybe a little bit, we just have to loosen our association with just this visual sense. But once we get the feeling of what's at the end of the finger here, visually, there's like this window filled with these colors and all. But as you said earlier, it's kind of what we're talking about is awareness, right? But we're calling it the looker. But we can say this sense of this open window in which all these appearances are happening, and more and more getting used to the relationship and the non-division between the inner and the outer here, visually. Then we just take the next sense is the sound, like the sound of this voice, almost as if it's another visual image, right? And we say, in getting used to feeling ourselves as this empty window, this single eye window, right? The single eye with kind of blurry edges that doesn't really have fixed edges. Then we hear the sound of the voice is appearing in the same window, right? So there's the sound, and we can apply the same thing to it. We don't exactly point at a sound, but you can almost feel like there's a voice coming from Kokyo's mouth over there. There's a sound. We can point kind of at that sound and say, and point back at our window and say, is there a division between that sound and the window in which the sound is entering? It's a little stretching, it's a little mixing of senses here.
You're adding another layering on, another dimension of that window,
Right, we're adding another dimension to the window, and we're kind of like trying not to get too nitpicky about it. I thought this was just a visual window. We're just starting to feel like it's just this present space. And of course, then sounds are happening. And if we're eating some food, there's a taste is like filling that window. You know, taste is interesting because it's not like, oh, it's a particular area of my tongue. I mean, it might be biologically, but we feel like when our mouth is full of chocolate or something, right? It's just like, it feels like, check it out next time you're eating chocolate or something strong flavor. Doesn't it feel like the flavor is actually not just in a mouth, but the flavor is permeating the space? You can try that. And smell, same. Smell, it's the nice thing about these senses is they're not so located anyway. The incense smell is like it's over there. No, it's just more like filling the space. And then bodily sensation is the last one. That maybe feels like, well, is this, I feel like it's located, this tension in the belly. Is that happening in this one-eyed window too? And yeah, I think this is what we're trying to open to. Yeah, it is. It's a particular maybe feeling, a pulsation, a vibration happening in a sort of area of the window. But in fact, that is where it's, aren't bodily sensations happening within this one eye also? So yeah, these are practices we can do in Zazen and really explore how all five sensory experiences are rising and ceasing, constantly changing within this single, unchanging, empty space.
The sensorium,
yeah, nice. What is this? What is my original sensorium before my parents were born? You could ask it like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Press and hold. Okay. Press and hold. There you go. So I'm not thoroughly confused, but so this thing about the original face suggests that there is something before the original.
Well, if it's original, how could there be anything before?
Well, exactly. Mm. So it's like, how did the originality just like wake up one day and just go like, hey, I'm it? And I'm also kind of looking at unpacking emptiness in my life up here. And I read somewhere that everything starts there. Is emptiness to the original face?
Yes.
Are they one and the same?
Mm-hmm. So in this case,
before the original face.
Yeah, I think we can say, right, there's nothing before. That's why it's originally original. And that's our discussion about, well, before our parents, before our grandparents, before the turtles and the amoeba, and before even sentient life, we can start, you know, it's beginningless. And then the way we can kind of sense that more experientially is the timeless exercise. So with watching the clock, right? This clock is moving out here. It's happening in time. Somebody built a clock at a certain time and they wound it, put a battery in at a certain time, and it started and it will end and it will be destroyed. And meanwhile, that movement is happening in this unmoving, unborn, timeless space. So I think experientially, if we think of it as timeless, that's maybe easier than a kind of conceptual idea of like, well, how old is it? It's before the universe is a little conceptual, but more like it's just every time we look, it's exactly the same situation. We feel like we're getting older, and our public face is getting more wrinkled and old, and it's aging. But meanwhile, our original face is not aging. Isn't that a nice thing for aging people? To remember that who we really are is not wrinkled and aging. It's and it wasn't actually born. That's maybe a big one, but it's timeless. I think unborn, deathless, and timeless are almost synonyms, but they have different flavors. So that's the first part. And then your second part is about emptiness. And yes, so there's many ways in Buddhist philosophy we can talk about emptiness. And like I said, Nagarjuna probably wouldn't like this way of talking about emptiness so much. Like I said this morning, he wouldn't say that form emerges from emptiness, for example. But other Buddhist traditions and other traditions are more comfortable talking this way. Like this Yogacara tradition says there's like mind, there's a storehouse consciousness that's like the ground of all appearances, and everything that appears emerges from the storehouse consciousness, and it is empty in a sense, and maybe even more accurately, because that has that's that model maybe doesn't fit with the Buddha nature teachings, particularly the Srimala Devi Sutra. That's one of our women ancestors is named Queen Srimala. And this sutra is a good one. And it teaches this Tathagatagarbha Buddha nature. And I think amongst all these sutras, this is the one that's most clear. Queen Srimala is teaching this in ancient India, and the Buddha is like in the assembly, kind of watching her teach it, and the Buddha just keeps saying, right on, Srimala Devi, you said it. And one of the things she says is that this Buddha nature is the like a ground and foundation of all conditioned experiences. Well, it itself is not a conditioned experience. So, and she says, it is emptiness. This Buddha nature is emptiness. So this is a case where she doesn't mind saying all these appearances are actually emerging from and have the nature of this empty Buddha nature. So that's one way of talking about emptiness. Our original face is emptiness. And the reason I like compare Nagarjuna's philosophy about emptiness is very conceptual. It's hard. It can give you a headache to try to unpack it. It's using logic. He's intending for us to use our logical reasoning to kind of come to the conclusion that everything is empty. But it's not, and then that conceptual reasoning can lead to a non-conceptual verification, like tasting water and knowing that it's warm. But this kind of method, I would say, is nice, and it's kind of more Zen style because it doesn't use conceptual reasoning. And in fact, if you start to use conceptual reasoning, you'll start doubting the whole thing. And you just think it's a stupid thing that Douglas Harding came up with. It's not Buddha Dharma. But if you stay kind of naive, you don't need any logic here. Logic kind of hinders it, in fact. Because the logic will say, well, I know it feels like there's nothing really here, but that's just because my eyeballs can't see themselves, and I know my face is really here. It's kind of like a little bit rational and logical. You have to kind of suspend that. No, in my direct experience right now, is there any face? Like, I can't find one, so my face is innocent until proven guilty. If I hold out a mirror and there it is, it's guilty. But my public face is guilty, but my secret face is never guilty because it can never be found. You can follow that. So, emptiness itself is form.
Thank you. This teaching is really clear and very beneficial. And I thought of Menju earlier, and I maybe talk about that later with you. But I've always been turned around by Dongshan's experience, where he saw his reflection. Oh, wow. And he said, you know, I am not it, mm-hmm. but it surely is me. And mm-hmm. I always was kind of turned around by that, but I think he... maybe because there's not mirrors all around in the all the time, maybe he was more shocked when he did see mm-hmm. his reflection. But mm-hmm. I think it clarifies that for me, that experience, deeper. And I really appreciate this teaching because it is experiential. It's like right there.
Yeah.
And it does, because I had a lot of concepts around mm-hmm. that experience. And this was so clear. And thank you. I think it helped. Add some clarity to that teaching as well, his experience. Because he saw his reflection and he said, I'm not it. And it surely is me. And sometimes I think I relate that to Narcissus's experience for some reason. I don't know, it's like in the back of my mind.
All these mirror stories, right?
But, yeah. And then I also kind of just see, I can picture Doug going, study the self. Study the self.
Yeah, and hopefully we can start feeling, I feel like doing these kind of exercises, it's like, oh, that's interesting, I can't see my face, but more like there's a sort of, we're feeling into like the profundity of what this is pointing to, of really feel like there is this empty spaciousness out of which emerges all these five sensory experiences. And Dongshan's story, I mean, I hesitate to get into it because it could be a whole other day in itself, but because I just did this spring practice period at Green Gulch studying Dongshan's Jewel Mirror Samadhi based on this story. So I was really reflecting, no pun intended, on this central verse. I think this the central verse of the song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, which probably not everybody has heard this, but maybe to try to be really brief, this is studying that verse, which, to be honest, I had a hard time with this verse because I think it's more dynamic and subtle than it appears. The verse in the poem goes, Dongshan, based on his awakening, seeing his reflection in the river. The verse says, it, and I think it is like reality, or our situation right now, is like facing a jewel mirror. Form and image, or form and reflection, behold each other. You are not it. In truth, it is you. So that verse seems kind of simple on the surface, but I think it's like, it's not just saying, because you could say this window that we're talking about today, you could say it's like a mirror, right? All the images reflected in this mirror, and they're one with the mirror, no dividing line between. But I don't think this verse is that simple, because it's saying it's like facing a jewel mirror. If it were that simple, Dongshan could have just said, it's like being a jewel mirror, and it is you. And you're not it, it is you. But he didn't say it. It's like facing a jewel mirror. Form and reflection behold each other. So the way that might not be what Dongshan intended, but my current take on this verse is very similar to what we're talking about today. But it's like the world that I'm seeing is like the mirror. Instead of like, I am the mirror, it's more like everywhere I look, I'm facing a jewel mirror. And then who's that me that's facing the jewel mirror? Is it form and reflection behold each other? I'm seeing it more like form in this metaphor in the poem is like the sense of subjectivity, a sense of a viewer, and the reflection is like the world of appearances in the mirror. So there's almost like several things going on. One is just everything I see is myself in the mirror. But then it's like this form and the image in the mirror are beholding each other. So like there's one of the things that appears in this dual mirror is a sense of like being a subject of experience, being a located person, but seeing the world. That's part of one of the reflections in the mirror is the sense of me. And then the world is the other thing, and almost like two mirrors. But that gets a little dualistic, so we just say it's one mirror, but there's in this mirror there's a form and image beholding each other. A little bit like Kokyo as the person is being created by all of you, and vice versa. That's like form and image beholding each other. We're dependently arising. And meanwhile, this whole interdependent arising of me and you is happening in this one undivided jewel mirror at the same time.
and then you are not it. What is the it? We could say the it could be the jewel mirror, but it could also be the reflection. This is why I think this is like, if you really start looking into this verse, it's like a very dynamic koan, actually. So, in other words, you are not it, in truth, it is you. From my perspective, you could say, I am not you, but you as a person are actually me. And at the same time, the undivided jewel mirror is me. This may be too much to try to like describe this today, but if you could follow that, it's quite dynamic, I think. And it's definitely related to what we're talking about. Yeah. The empty window, it could also be called an empty mirror. And the mirror, of course, shows up in the poems of the Platform Sutra too. These are all like analogies trying to talk about something that is very hard to talk about directly. So the Zen has all these metaphors. Yes?
Yeah, that's uncanny how this came up, because I was thinking of, just as we've been talking about visual perception and then going into the other senses, one thing that has been on my mind and trying to grok in my experience is collapsing attention, and I feel like you just explained it for me in terms of the feeling of subjectivity, a form, and the image or whatever attention is attending to that is appearing within us, the space. It's appearing within spaceless space.
Yeah, both the sense of subjectivity and the sense of objectivity.
Yes.
Right, got it.
And kind of like, you know, talking about tracing one of the senses back to that boundless space, tracing back the sense of visual perception back to boundless space, trying to do that with the two things that catch me is attention and intention. And so working with those two, trying to see that form and image behold each other within this space is something I've been trying to work on. I feel like you just put words to what I've been trying to. Yeah.
Another way, and I hate to try these attempts because each one of these could be a long unpacking, but a really beautiful Dharma expression that I appreciate a lot is Zen teacher Sungmi. Sungmi was very early, like around the time, actually before the Six Ancestors, so very early Chan in China. And he was an ancestor in the Chan lineage and also an ancestor in the Huayan, or flower ornament, Avatamsaka school in China. So he had that unique perspective of the Zen. It's a very direct pointing kind of school. And then this highly philosophical, but Buddha nature and dependent arising and everything, flower ornament world and philosophy. So one of the things I think he invented was this part of his kind of philosophy of how things work, is he called nature arising. This comes from the Flower Ornament Sutra, from one of the chapters. It's called nature arising, which basically means, kind of like what we've been talking about, that the way all appearances, all experiences arise is from Buddha nature, for short, nature. Nature arising. So in other words, it's like this one, right? That this is the Buddha nature, our original face, our unborn, empty, timeless original face, and all the world is arising from Buddha nature. And that's kind of expressed sometimes in the flower ornament, and Srimala Devi Sutra exactly says this. So that's called, and he says, this is the most profound way of understanding how things come to be. Everything is an expression of this unchanging Buddha nature. And then He says, but what about dependent arising? That's the central teaching of the Buddha. How does that fit into the story? And he says, that's another kind of arising. There's nature arising as Buddha nature, and then there's dependent arising, which is explaining more like the particularities of how the particular images arise dependent on other images. So he's saying it's in a way it's a more ultimate, I think he says more like profound, deeper view to say everything is arising from Buddha nature. But then if we want to, that doesn't explain how particular things arise, but dependent arising is like within nature arising, there is dependent arising, which is like a kind of a one step up. So a way we could try to describe this in a metaphor is you could say there's the mirror, this window or this mirror of Buddha nature, and the mirror gives rise to all the reflections on it. They are just the play of the mirror. That's called nature arising. But then on the mirror, there's these different images that arise dependent on each other. So dependent arising is the pattern that's playing out on the surface of the mirror. If you can follow that. Both are true, dependent arising and nature arising, but they're like two little levels of understanding, we might say. And then dependent arising is the self and other kind of like sense of subjectivity and objectivity. So there's this one boundless Buddha nature mirror on which everybody and everything is arising and ceasing, and its nature is just the mirror. And then within this mirror, that where we're living all the time, there's you and I are having a conversation, and I feel like I'm over here talking to you, and you're creating me, and I'm creating you. And so that's the dependent arising of Kodi and Kokyo interacting on the surface of this mirror. So you could say what we really are is just the nature of the mirror arising as stuff. But then if we want to get more particular, you could say we're dependently arising as two different people. And both are true. Can you see?
Yeah, I see what
you mean. I really like this. It's a more philosophical way of talking, but these two levels of, could you follow that? Some people, this might be getting late in the day for this kind of thing.
Huh? I think it does give, it gives a way, it gives words to two different ways of experiencing the same space.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you could say for Dungshan's verse in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, you could say, it's like me facing the jewel mirror, it's like facing a jewel mirror. Kokyo and Kodi behold each other. And then Kokyo is not really Kodi or the mirror. You could say that's it. But the mirror is Kokyo and Kodi is Kokyo. See how these... In that verse of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, you can see it as Sungmi's teaching of... It's describing nature arising and dependent arising in this one verse. You might have to contemplate that.
Yeah, the last line, I think I'm going to have to contemplate.
We're trying to put work, and you could say, this is getting too much. Why don't we just sit? Because but in fact, if we just sit, we may be just like, oh yeah, okay, I'm sitting, I'm this body, I gotta like start breathing and like get present and like, that's all good, but this is like trying to kind of shift the whole perspective, kind of break open our usual thing of like, I'm this person that shouldn't be just be sitting now and stop all this thinking.
Isn't that kind of what mind only is all about?
What's that?
Whatever it was you just said.
Yeah, I think mind only is maybe more on the dependent arising side. Yogacara tradition is more about how subject and object dependently arise, and both of them are arising and ceasing, and all of it is dependent arising. And strictly speaking, the early Yogacara doesn't bring up this Buddha nature stuff.
Buddha nature.
It's kind of a separate.
Just say the universal life
But it also includes the death force. It's not exactly, I mean, a friend of mine says, can't we just call it life? And I say, well, I can kind of see where you're going. Some people might call it that. But the problem is then we think of like metabolism, you know, and breathing. And I'm like, those are like the manifestations of Buddha nature. Buddha nature is unchanging, emptiness. So, and it, I would say it manifests as life force. But life force is already a little too much like something.
Was this a way of reconciling Buddha nature teachings with dependent origination,
mm-hmm.
all in a dream?
Is it all in a dream?
Because dependent origination is like a more like a I would say like a contingent relative teaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So. But
even Nagarjuna would say dependent arising is a kind of conventional truth.
Conventional truth.
Because it's about what arises.
Yeah, but
ceases.
When you switched it to on the surface of a mirror, like a dreamlike thing,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Then that changes the sense of substantiality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the Buddha nature, but I think Cody mm-hmm. mentioned. Well, I don't know what Cody mentioned, but I remember what you mentioned, part of what you mentioned in response to him. It was the Buddha nature kind of as a creator,
mm-hmm.
pseudo-creator of
mm-hmm.
all these things on a surface of a mirror. So again, the dreamlike quality. And
mm-hmm.
on the surface of that mirror, things rise and fall and interact dependently.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah. So and you can see, and that's why you could see that.
So it's a beautiful analogy this Cody made actually to unify these two teachings.
Yeah, that analogy kind of shows that what Sung Mi calls nature arising, that all the images are just arising from the mirror as the mirror. And that's kind of what we're exploring today, more the nature arising. This world is actually. Is this empty window, right? That's the, I would say more of the Buddha nature arising. This world is arising as this empty, unchanging window, and there's no division between them. We can really explore that nature arising, and then we have this classic Buddhist teaching of dependent arising, and it fits in, but it fits in as like more like forget about that it's all Buddha nature. Now we're just looking at two things appearing in relation to each other, and you could say that's like the two images on the mirror relating to, you know, co-creating each other on the mirror. But then meanwhile, those two images dependently arising on the mirror, what is the nature, the ultimate nature of those images? It's the mirror, right? That's what they are made of, actually, is the mirror. So yeah, I think you got how these two sides work together, and you can, if you can grok that metaphor, then you can consider it as applying to our experience right now. This is what this saying is like. This, you and I are dependently arising in this conversation, and meanwhile, both of us are nothing but this unchanging mirror. Both are true. Simultaneously. So, yeah. We've exhausted our conceptual stories about this. So happy about it. Now we can just, for the last bit of sitting, without thinking of all these Buddhist models,
What is your original face? Oh yeah, so simple. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. So simple. The models are good. We need, because we're conceptual beings and we have a lot of other unexamined conceptual models that we carry around all day, so it's good to look at them. But at the time of Zazen, this one, turn the light around, shine it back. Put aside the intellectual thinking. What is it?
Pursuit of words and phrases.
Yeah. Put aside the intellectual practice of pursuing words and following after speech. And learn. It takes a while to learn it. Slowly learn the backward step. A forward step is this one. Learn the backward step. It turns the light around and shines it back. Body and mind as we used to know them originally drop away of themselves. And your original face will manifest. If you want, sometimes we translate, if you want such a thing, get to work on such a thing immediately. It's one translation.